Good morning. Our first guest this morning is Taylor Jaworski, an assistant professor at the University of Colorado. As we think about Memorial Day coming up next week, we think a lot about the human cost of war. But this is a business show, and we thought it might be interesting to think about the economics of war. Many of us were taught in school that the Depression ended because of the mobilization associated with World War II. I've often wondered what exactly that meant and whether it was true or not. And among many other questions, we're going to get a chance to talk to Taylor about that this morning. Good morning, Taylor. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Taylor, tell us a little bit about what the mobilization for World War II meant to the U.S. economy.
Well, there's sort of two aspects, I think, to think about, and they're distinct in sort of their economic impacts. One is the manpower mobilization. That is the drafting or volunteering of over 10 million people to serve in the military, to serve on the military fronts of the war. And then the other is the industrial mobilization, sort of the massive effort to reorient the U.S. economy to supply the Allied war effort, which includes both on the domestic front, feeding people, and on the military front, you know, putting together all of the industrial might of the U.S. economy to fight and win World War II.
And let's start with the second. Let's focus on the second one for a minute, the industrial change. How is it that the economy was able to shift, and what was the nature of that shift?
Well, I think that it's certainly the case that the military had in mind a set of objectives, and then the challenge then becomes how to sort of take an economy that is a market economy and reorient that toward a set of very narrow objectives, right? I mean, the military gets to decide sort of how resources are allocated, or gets to decide what are the most important things about allocating those resources. And so, I mean, the U.S. took a unique approach in sort of the scheme of World War II, in that they, where they had to and where they felt they needed to, military planners and civilian planners sort of used, we'll call them coercive mechanisms. You know, this is how resources will be allocated. But where they could, they also tried to not do that and sort of let the market work in some ways, at least in comparison to other countries, to sort of help allocate those resources. So it was certainly a time in which the U.S. government was intervening a lot in the economy, but I think much less so relative to other countries, the U.K., the Soviet Union, and Germany, for example.
Taylor, what about Roger's question? You know, there's the Great Depression's going on, World War II has started, the U.S. has really had an isolationist type attitude at the beginning of World War II. FDR was famous, and I'm paraphrasing his quote, that the U.S. would be the arsenal for democracy for World War II, but we weren't going to get involved was the initial thinking. So what was the impact of the U.S. economy of being able to be this arsenal for democracy?
Yeah, I mean, so this is one of the most important and maybe one of the most controversial, and as a result, one of the least there's the least consensus on this question for this time period related to sort of the war's role in recovery. I think that the dominant view is that World War II, among economists and among economic historians, is that World War II didn't play this sort of decisive role in pulling the economy out of World War II, out of the Great Depression. On the one hand, I think there's a group of people who think sort of that recovery began earlier, say, from 1936 afterward, so, you know, from 1936 to 37 to 38, and sort of really before the U.S. gets involved in World War II, that's when you can sort of start to see the beginnings of a recovery, you know, and then some people will dispute that. And I think the other view is that, you know, you really don't see a recovery sort of to the traditional kind of peacetime economy, functioning of a peacetime economy, until after World War II, sort of after 1945 into 46, 47, and 48, after demobilization has happened. I think that what looks like a boom in the U.S. economy during World War II is, in fact, a lot of things that are kind of hard to interpret as sort of necessarily improving the welfare of the American people. I mean, we're going to go back to my answer earlier that, you know, there really is a lot of government allocation of resources going on, and that means that, you know, people might find it hard to consume exactly the things they want. And so I think that economists and economic historians really have the view that the recovery either began, and they might be split on this, that the recovery began before World War II or kind of after World War II, after sort of the traditional activities that we associate with the war.
So let's talk a little bit about just the sort of raw changes that were going on. We've talked about how, to some extent, there was what we call coercive measures by the War Department to manufacture what it did. But what happened, for example, to the gross domestic product during this period? As we moved into these sort of into the pursuit of the war.
Yeah, so measured GDP goes up. I mean, there's kind of no doubt about that. I mean, you can try to sort of construct different measures of GDP, and you can sort of fiddle with those numbers, and you can change them a little bit. But I think it wouldn't be correct to say that sort of GDP goes down, or that GDP doesn't just go up by quite a bit. But then we sort of have to think about, you know, what's going into that measure. And I think that economists sort of like to think about, or the way that this is thought about in the context of World War II is sort of thinking about the civilian economy and the military economy, or sort of the civilian and military components driving sort of that aggregate number. And what I think you, when you decompose the economy that way, what you see is that the military part of that is really driving the increase in output, and that's an accomplishment. I mean, we can sort of be proud of that in some way. But I think that sort of how we think about that translating to civilians is much harder. And so, I mean, measured GDP goes up, but sort of what the benefits that consumers, you know, what American citizens are getting from that, other than, you know, winning an important war, which is important, you know, we don't see that sort of directly. It's sort of really improving the day-to-day welfare of Americans, if that makes sense.
And let's talk a little bit about the sort of costs, the economic costs of the war to the American public, in different economic measures.
Yeah, so I mean, we want to think. I mean, we can sort of look at GDP, we can look at unemployment, and these numbers tend to change, I think, in ways that are favorable. But I think as economists, we also want to think about the other costs, sort of the hidden costs, what economists like to call the opportunity costs, right? So, you know, what didn't happen as a result of forcing the economy to mobilize for World War II? We get a reallocation of resources, and that means that resources are being allocated to the particular objective of winning the war, but they're also not being used privately by consumers or by firms to do other things. So that's kind of one. We want to think about what those costs of kind of misallocation or the reallocation of resources are. The other one is that, you know, as I mentioned at the very beginning, there's sort of this manpower mobilization going on. And that manpower mobilization is largely coercive. It's largely done through the selective service, through the draft, right? And so those people are being forced to serve in the military at kind of lower wages than you might expect them to earn in the labor market, in the private labor market. And so we also, you know, we want to think about what the costs of that are. And then kind of going forward in time, as the U.S. Pays for or needs to pay for the war, sort of what are the future tax costs of the war? And I think all of those things together mean that, you know, World War II was a success militarily. You might even say, despite some caveats, that the war was a success economically. But we don't want to sort of miss that it was costly in many ways. That it was costly to the people who fought in it. It was costly to the consumers and to the people who lived through it. And then it had costs on future generations as we thought about paying for the fiscal costs of that war into the future. And so, you know, all those things I think aggregate to mean that, you know, it was probably or almost certainly a good thing to do, but that it was more costly, I think, than sometimes we understand. War is costly.
War is costly, obviously, in dollars, but more importantly in lives. And we'd be remiss if we didn't thank the Greatest Generation for their efforts in World War II and for bringing successful ending to World War II. Was a horrible time, and it took a lot of courage and a lot of guts to do what has been done. If you're just joining us, our guest is Taylor Jaworski. He is an assistant professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he's written several publications on the economics of World War I and World War II. And they include, there's one publication that's titled Two World Wars in American Economic History. There's another publication, World War II and the Industrialization of the American South. And a third publication, You're in the Army Now, The Impact of World War II on Women's Education. Let's talk about that third topic, your study on the impact on women's education. What role did World War II have in advancing women's educational paths?
Yeah, so this is where this is kind of a standard sort of thing that economists like to do, is think about sort of the trade-offs that different people face at different points in time. And in this paper, what I was trying to do is think about the trade-off, potentially faced by young women who were sitting in high school in the early 1940s, and then the war begins, and they want to think about whether they should complete high school. Right, so whether they're in 11th or 12th grade and they should go on to graduation, or whether they should drop out to take advantage of potentially good labor market opportunities. And what I show in this paper is that the war did indeed provide attractive labor market opportunities, and that many of these young women decided to drop out and not complete, say, that final year of secondary school, and they entered the labor market. And this meant that generation sort of experienced less labor market accumulation early on, less human capital or less educational, less education than they would have otherwise. And so what happened is these women dropped out. They went to work in this booming economy, you know, that needed people to work in it. But they didn't get that last year of education that maybe would have been useful as we transition from a war to a peacetime economy, and many of these women are going to work in sort of white-collar clerical positions. That was sort of a big occupation that women worked in that actually required a good amount of education. And so maybe some of these women didn't get to play a role in that sort of labor market after World War II. And then what I ultimately show is that these women, yes, they dropped out of school to enter the workforce during World War II. Maybe they didn't get the opportunity to stay in the labor market after World War II ended. They started families earlier than the typical woman, so they got married and had more children earlier on. But ultimately, what I provide some evidence for is that these women, you know, after sort of completing the process of raising their children, they eventually did actually go back to school. So after 1960, into the 1960s and 1970s, they went back and completed that final year of school. And so it sort of delayed their educational attainment, but didn't suppress it sort of ultimately. They were able to go back and get that after doing what they were doing in the household.
And if you compare the participation of women in the workforce before the war and after the war, is it fair, does it appear that the war itself and that mobilization of women had a long-term impact on the nature of the labor force in this country?
Yeah, so I think that what you see is that it is the case that women entered the labor force, but it's not the case that they stayed in the labor force. And so that I think actually fits with the kind of the story that I was telling in this paper, is that, you know, these women are able to enter the labor force, but many of them leave in 1945 and in 1946. It's not always the case that they were forced out, although there are some instances of women sort of being replaced by men returning home from the war, but it is the case that by the time you get to the 1950, many of the women who had entered because of World War II, almost half of them are no longer there. Kind of the best evidence that we can provide on that.
And speaking of the 1950s, you know, post World War II, the U.S. saw one of its strongest economic climates ever. And, you know, just as a outside observer, to me, it seems logical as the war ended and there was rebuilding throughout Europe and Asia, people were coming home, they were starting families, they were buying homes, they had to furnish it. The reality is much of the world's productive capabilities had been blown to smithereens during the war, and the U.S. really had these factories that were capable of doing production. How much of that, as an outside observer, is accurate? Was it in fact the case that there was this world demand that was increasing post the war, and most countries didn't have the facilities in place to do production? Is that accurate, or is that another myth?
No, I think there's a lot of truth in that, although you're getting into the most controversial topics in the economic history of World War II. But I think economists are and economic historians of this period have tried to be really careful to not over attribute too many good things to sort of World War II directly. And so I think the story that you brought up, sort of the line of thinking that you mentioned, I think is sort of the right one, which is that the U.S. is sort of this place, this industrial power, untouched by the destructive reach of World War II. And as a result of that, it's sort of in a position to provide many of the goods and potentially services to the rest of the world. So it's not really a direct effect of World War II. It's not that World War II changed dramatically and forever the productive capabilities of the U.S. economy. It's that the sort of World War II left the U.S. economy as the major industrial economy to serve the world.
And that sort of is an interesting place to segue into a paper you wrote about the industrialization of the American South. I mean, I grew up in the South, and I guess I had the sense that even 60 or 70 years after the Civil War, the South was predominantly not very industrial. Can we talk a little bit about how the war changed that?
Yeah, so I think that the evidence that I provide and the work that I have done suggests that sort of the South, from the postbellum period, from the period starting at the end of the Civil War, kind of all the way to World War II was not an industrial economy. It wasn't the primary industrial area of the U.S. But that was changing, albeit probably pretty slowly, say between 1880 and 1940. And then there was this common belief that sort of World War II had the potential to kind of shock the South out of this kind of pre-industrial or less industrial economy and to become much more industrial. And the evidence I provide is that probably wasn't true for many of the reasons that we've been talking about. Military kind of orienting the economy toward the military isn't the same thing as orienting the economy toward the civilian production. And so the things that happened in the South as a part of World War II were important and could be valuable, but they weren't sort of valuable into the future. And the South does ultimately industrialize, but that's sort of part of a long-run trend rather than a direct effect, again, of World War II.
And how about some of these secondary impacts of the military and of the economy and of the impact of our workforce employees? For instance, my father served in the Korean War. Fortunately, he never saw combat. But when he was in high school, he had lied about his age and gotten a job at Standard Oil. You could do that back in those days. There weren't many ways to check whether you were telling the truth on that kind of stuff. So he worked at Standard Oil before he went to the Navy, came back 4 years later, and his friends told him, hey, Standard Oil has to give you your job back. And he didn't know that, and that was a huge boom for him. There's that, and now there's also the GI Bill. You know, what is the impact of this employers taking back people that have gone off to war as well as the GI Bill? Do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, so the employer policy, there hasn't been, as far as I know, much work that's been done on that, sort of much systematic work that said, you know, what was the effect of these policies that kind of forced companies to or encouraged companies strongly to give jobs back to the people returning. There's been quite a bit of work done on the GI Bill, and it's certainly, I think, you know, what you see is lots of evidence that that men returning from the war benefited educationally or in terms of something like home ownership from these GI Bill policies. So one related to subsidies that allowed men to gave subsidies to or gave cash to men to attend college, and then also allowed veterans to obtain mortgages on favorable terms in the post-war period. Both of those things, I think, there's been a lot of work done on that, and the evidence is pretty convincing that educational attainment went up and home ownership went up as a result of these policies.
Let me ask you a follow-up to that. What in aggregate, for the soldiers that left, you know, I watch World War II movies, documentaries. You see these now. I'm in my mid-50s. They look like kids to me now. But when I was younger, when I was in my 20s, just thinking, could you imagine being sucked out of your career, the beginning of your career, to go off to fight a war? And what kind of impact did that have in aggregate for the soldiers? Was it economically, over the arc of their lives, was it a positive thing or was it a huge negative?
I think the evidence would probably not come down on the side that it was a huge negative, but I think it's very hard to tell. I mean, we have, I think, a good amount of evidence about some of the positive things, educational attainment. You know, you could probably think about that as related to earnings, home ownership, as being good things to come out of World War II. But you know, you can also think about those things as compensation for the costs that these men bore. And as a result, I think it's sort of hard to imagine that, you know, the benefits were so much larger than those costs. I mean, those costs must have been substantial, right? Sort of the psychological and, you know, even if they weren't killed in battle, you know, sort of the psychological costs and the physical costs that came from surviving war must have been substantial. So I think, as an economist, I want to try to put numbers to things, but I also want to be careful to not overclaim what I can be precise about. And I think those costs, I think, is something that we would find it hard to be precise about.
My father, Doug, was shot down over Germany in June of 1944 and got to spend about 14 months as a guest of Adolf Hitler. So the cost of being an American POW and how that affected the rest of his life was pretty dramatic, as you could imagine, and would be hard for an economist to quantify. I have one last quick question for you.
Yep.
Which goes to this. We spend a lot of money and energy creating these industrial plants to fight the war. What do we see about the extent to which that kind of investment was able to be converted productively into civilian uses?
Yeah, so there is a little bit of evidence on this, and I think that the evidence is that it wasn't kind of worthless. I mean, one extreme view that you could adopt is that, you know, all of that stuff was completely useless when it came. All that military mobilization was completely useless when it came to the civilian economy. And I think that's not where the evidence is. The evidence is that, you know, it probably didn't translate one for one into civilian uses, but that you were able. The military was able for the property that it owned, for the plants that it owned, or for the plants that it supplied the loans for, those plants were able to be redeployed probably at sort of 50% of their ultimate value, or close to 50% of their ultimate value. And so it's not that it was a complete zero in the post-war U.S. economy, but it wasn't just this incredible boon that, you know, well, we made tanks, now we can just as easily make cars. I mean, those are similar activities, but they're not the same activity.
Well, on that note, Taylor, we need to wrap up. Our guest this morning has been Taylor Jaworski. He is an assistant professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. We thank you for joining us, and we salute all those who have served in the past for our country. Thank you for your service, and Taylor, thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks so much.